Friday the 19th, in the late afternoon, and I will not tell you where it is, but you can gather all the information. I will not tell you where it is, but I will say something wrong. You're responsible for the whole semester. The lectures and the reading. There probably will be two questions, and they will not necessarily be one of the lectures and one of the reading, because I'll expect you to use the total information you have to answer these questions. Now, the course has consisted of my efforts to increase your understanding of the world of the 20th century, not only the world of the third block, the underdeveloped areas, whatever you want to call it, but also our own Western civilization, and for the last month, about our own United States, which of course are part of Western civilization. Today is my last day of teaching, and I have been teaching for 41 years on the university level. If I were to go back a little, I'm 45 years older than you. And 41 of those I've been teaching in universities. If I were to go back to my stage that you're in, let us say sophomore year, some of you are sophomore, but I'm assuming you're sophomore, you're about 20. We're in a tremendous crisis in the United States in 1930. Today, 1975, we are in a much worse crisis. The crisis that we were in 1930, or the crisis that took me many years of analysis. I was studying at that time economics. And I found, by early 1931, in other words, before the final exam in the first semester of my economics course, that economics was an enormous accumulation of myths that had very little relationship to reality. For example, we were in an acute depression with 13 million, one quarter of the employed of the United States, unemployed. In Germany, it was even worse, their situation. And I finally came up with what seemed to me an explanation. I'm going to put it on the board here. This is the crisis of 1933. And it consists of something like this. That is, if there is demand, this creates confidence. If there is confidence, this leads to investment. If there is investment, this creates purchasing power. If there is purchasing power, this creates demand. There was an inadequate purchasing power. The result is there was inadequate demand. The result was there was little confidence and no investment. The result was that our economy was filled with goods that could not be sold. The reason, the key reason for this, of course, was there was an unequal distribution of the national income, so that a small group of people were getting a very large part. About 2% of the population were getting at least a quarter of the national income. And about 60% of the population were getting less than a quarter, I think it was 22%, of the national income. The result was that consumer's goods could not be sold because people didn't have consumer's goods. Didn't have the purchasing power to buy the things that they needed, and they were hungry. And as a result, they had enormous accumulations of wheat and cotton and unsold automobiles, unsold everything. And we had idle men, idle factories, and idle money, and we couldn't bring those together. The only way to bring them together in the system was to build more factories. But nobody's going to build more factories where you cannot sell what the existing factories have available. Their warehouses are loaded. So why build more factories to produce more goods? The reason is that already the American economy was a cancer economy. And a cancer economy is a system which has intrinsic built into it unrestrained growth, and you cannot stop it, even though it kills what it is in. So your body, when it's killed by cancer, if it is, will be killed because parts of your body cells are growing and growing and growing and growing, and they are not going to stop growing. Now, this was this system. There was a tremendous controversy. The controversy was over between those who said, the only way to stop this thing going is to increase confidence. Those we called Republicans or conservatives. And during the campaign of 1932, Franklin Roosevelt was one of these. He said we must balance the budget, reduce spending, restore confidence, and so forth. Now, I'll go very briefly, although you've read it in the book, you should understand it. They increased confidence by increasing the value of the money, of the dollar. In order to keep the value of the dollar high, they said you must keep on the gold standard. In order to make the value of the dollar high, and you know this now, you must have low prices. Because the lower prices go, the more you can buy with a dollar, and this increases confidence in the dollar. So the people who are concerned with the value of the dollar are the people who have savings, and they will not invest those savings unless they see that the value of the prices are low. Furthermore, they will not invest savings unless they see the costs are low. Because if you drive prices down, this decreases wages, decreases rents, decreases the cost of material. Here it is, land, labor, materials, energy, legal costs, management. If you are going to invest, you're going to spend money for these things. We call that rent, wages, cost of materials, cost of energy, fees for lawyers, salary for management, so on and so forth. And if you are going to do that, then if costs are low, but what had happened here is, you're not going to do it because you also have to sell the goods you can produce. And that's a question of purchasing power. So what the New Deal did, and the New Deal was not a success, it did not reform the system. In fact, Franklin Roosevelt was an extreme conservative. And you can, what you've read in the book, we show you that. For example, he had the right to issue 50 million, was it, in greenbacks, and he held that for more than 12 years and never issued a dollar. Nobody could just print it, money, and given it to people to increase purchasing power. Instead, he thought that if he put purchasing power in here, and this is the New Deal, this is Keynesian economics, put purchasing power in there, the system will go. The old method, Herbert Hoover and the bankers and so forth said, increase confidence there. But to them, increasing confidence means deflation. So this is a deflationary crisis. Today we have a totally different kind of a crisis. Much worse. For one thing, it's an inflationary crisis. You can see that. The reason is that banks have changed totally their role. Back in that period, banks had a creditor status. That is, money was owed to them. Creditors like low prices. Inflation injures creditors, because it makes the value of the money owed to you greater. You have to understand these principles, either from economics or from what you read in my book. Because of the fact that bankers were deflationary here, they held only credits. And any organization they controlled held only credits. For example, they controlled insurance companies. Insurance companies invested their money almost entirely in bonds. They controlled various other banks. These various other banks invested their money only in bonds. There was one man who dominated this whole economic system of 1930, J.P. Morgan. and you read about it in my book. J.P. Morgan largely controlled and certainly controlled the investments of Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and a number of other places, but not Princeton. It was controlled by the Prudential Insurance Company through a man named Duffield. And when Duffield's president was president of Princeton for 25 years, I guess this is in the book, I don't take time to tell you, they presented him with a car. He immediately went out and killed himself and his wife by running into a tree. So Duffield made himself president of Princeton for 1 year. And there he met a man who was so stupid, so insecure, that he knew he would obey him. So he made him president. His name was Harold Dodd. And the dean of Princeton said to me one time, "Good God, we can't stand this guy." I lived with the dean of Princeton in his house, in part of his house, in separate ends, in separate bathroom, but I lived with him. His name was Dodd. He said, "We can't stand this guy." He says, "Jim Conant may lead Harvard down a rat hole, but at least you leave him." Because what happened? Duffield put Dodd in, and he died, leaving Dodd for years with no one to tell him what to do. So he had breakdowns every 2 years, and they had to hide him away for 18 months. And yet he remained in Princeton. I know these things because I know these people. I lived with them. On a daily basis, I knew what was happening, both at Harvard and at Princeton. My first job, 41 years ago, was Princeton. They ran me back to teach at Harvard. Now, this then is a totally different system. All the universities were in endowments, were in bonds, not in stocks, not in equity. They set up foundations. Foundations were invested in bonds. If you are in bonds, then you want deflation because you are interested in the value of money. But if you leave bonds and cease being a creditor and become an owner, then you have everything that you want in what we call equity. And if you're in equities, you want inflation. Today, all the banks, all of the endowments of the old universities, and all of the holdings of the Rockefellers are in equities. I have a very extensive list of the holding of the Rockefellers. The Rockefeller family today is much more dominant than J.P. Morgan was back here. But it's an entirely different system. They own equities. These people had claims to wealth. Therefore, they were deflationary. Today, we are in the middle of an inflation, which is deliberate. Now, I cannot produce telephone recordings which prove that these bankers is deliberate. But it's perfectly obvious to anyone who watches. For example, the interest rate, the discount rate, by the chief banks in New York, controlled by the Rockefellers and their associates, in the past year and a half have lowered the interest rate from 12% to 7%. Nothing could be more inflationary than that. Now, in a moment, eventually, at the end, I'll explain why they're doing this. Very good reason for it. In the meantime, let's look at our economic system. If we look at a single enterprise, microeconomics, you're expanding this, let me start with a broad definition, capitalism. Capitalism is an economic system motivated by the pursuit of profit within a price structure. And it's been around for a long time. It's been around since about 1200. But you are seeking profits. What are profits? Profits are selling for more than you spend. All right, here's the cost of production. Here is the selling price you wish. This is profits. This is what you're after. In the capitalist system, you are supposed to maximize profits. This is what I call insatiable greed. It's all a matter of vocabulary. Maximizing profits and insatiable greed are exactly the same thing. It means you are never satisfied with your profits, whatever they are. But there's something very strange about this. If each factory is given into the market, and you know what the market is like, the market is a place where people come with money, people come with goods, and they try to exchange them. And if you increase the supply of goods, it is deflationary. Increase the supply of money, it's inflationary, and so forth. You know all about this. And what happens is, suppliers of goods compete with each other to lower prices. Suppliers of money compete with each other to raise prices. And suppliers of goods and suppliers of money hickle together to arrive at a price. And it will be successful if they arrive at a price which clears the market of all goods that came into it and of all money that came into it. So all the money in the market is exchanged for all the goods being offered to the market. I'm simply giving you the most obvious things that you must know. Alright. Any single enterprise, in a moment, anyone wants, has put into the market only this. But it is trying to sell this price. Selling price is greater than cost of production, right? Suppose there are N enterprises put N times selling prices into the market, and they're now trying to take out N times, I got the other way around. Yes, brute power is the same thing. They put into the market this much, and they're trying to take this much out. Thus, each enterprise and the total of the whole economic activity is trying to take out of the market more than to put in. Utterly impossible. How can you take out more than was put in? The answer is simple. I have given you here only a moment of time. The moment of time falsifies anything. These are flows. All right, now make this a whole economic system. A flow of rents. A flow of wages, a flow of all of these, and a flow of profits. And since the profits are now flowing through the market too, you will have enough money, won't you, presumably, to buy the goods. Because since the profits are flowing in and making purchasing power, this, then, is the total of purchasing power. But it is also the income of the system. So the total income of the system is the total selling price of all goods and services being produced, which is also, presumably, the total purchasing power available. So it should work. However, as I showed you before, it will not work because that total income is inequitably distributed, and much more so today than in 1933. Much more so. In other words, I don't have the exact figures now, but the poorest 5% today control much larger incomes, much, much larger than they did in 1930. The incomes of a single family, the Rockefellers today, is so fantastic that they themselves could never tell you how much it is. Just as they were finding considerable difficulty telling you exactly what they control and what they don't control. But I can assure you that all the figures given by Nelson Rockefeller under oath at confirmation hearings were false. And he admitted that because he changed them three times. He signed setting them up. One case he jumped up, I think, 100 million. The thing is, he has no income. He could say, my income is zero.
as all families. So, in fact, that system broke down because they divided up. Because the DuPonts divided up among the individual members of the family, and the result is the DuPonts broke through the courts today. Rather than speaking, they control Delaware, and they were very significant political power in Florida because of Albert P. DuPont's estate, which is being manipulated by a man who must be 90 now. Albert P. DuPont died, my guess would be 25 years ago. His estate is still living in Florida. But in any case, it has nothing to do with the Christiana DuPont up in Zelda. Whether he's on their own. But in the course of the Rockefeller system, there's five major corporations and they run by one man. And not his name is not Rockefeller. He gave testimony after a confirmation hearing that he gave answers to all questions. But he's the man who runs the Rockefeller system. But in any case, it's a totally different kind of system. Now, notice what we have is the foes of adequate get their all spent. Something I'm not all spent. Because very rich people cannot possibly spend all their income. And even poor people like me do not spend all of our income. We save. And we may put it in the bank. We may put it into anything. But notice, we put it into medical insurance, life insurance. We put it into retirement pensions. So on and so forth, all of this is spending. Furthermore, all of such spending by middle-class people, including your parents and me, is middle-class, and it makes the middle classes the only significant credited group in our society today. People have claims on money for retirement, insurance of all kinds, and money. The Rockefellers don't have any of this. They own property, and their income's from property. All right, notice. This, then, is the amount of purchasing power. It's the same as the amount of selling prices, so the goods should... I'm leaving out a lot of things. Now, there is a considerable amount taken in the form of taxes by the government, and there is a considerable amount saved. These two things make the purchasing power inadequate. Now, what I should have done here to do this, is all right, you have the government here, you have corporations here. The chief saving in the United States today is by corporations because they have the chief income. Most of the income in the United States does not go to living people. It goes to corporations. And they then invest it or do anything they want with it. You saw that $100 million a year was being spent illegally by the Library of Congress study issued 2 weeks ago by 24 corporations. All right, that is part of their savings. So bribes, expenditures of all kinds, political contributions, everything is, now that goes, is savings. It may go into savings banks, that's SB. It may go into investment banks, that's what J.P. Morgan was. By investment banks, I mean you buy securities or bonds. Or it may go into commercial banks, and they presumably will put it out into the system as investment. All right, so we'll say his savings coming in, and his investment going out. But there is a word. Credit. Commercial banks can make money whenever they please. They can increase or decrease the supply of money. And this is well established, and I give you quotes in my book from innumerable authorities.
Yeah, beginning with Gladstone in 1852, where the thing that hardly got started, and ending up with the Wall Street Journal, I think in 1931, is the quotation that I have in my book, and I have a number of other quotations from people. Reginald McKenna would be the chief one. Reginald McKenna's quotation, and he was Chancellor of the Exchequer in England and was the chairman of the board, the largest banking system in England. It was in those days called the Inland, the Midland Bank. All right, they make money, so here's credit, which is a money-making thing. This means that they can put into the system here more than came out here, if they wish. At the same time, of course, the government is taking money in taxes. But notice, taxes come almost entirely from natural persons. Now I'm going to put a dichotomy here. And then there are what are called in Latin and in the old law, persona ficta, and I will put it down that way. Fictitious person, a corporation. If you look at the taxes paid by large corporations, they are infinitesimal. I pay between a quarter and a third of my income in taxes. And if I include local taxes, then it's a third of my income, so 33%. Very few corporations, and none of the big ones, pay more than 5%. And they do that, make that appear by very tricky bookkeeping. If it were a solid analysis of what they were paying, it would be less than 5%. So what goes up in taxes here is largely from natural persons, not from corporations. And the government may spend those taxes. In fact, it does. Well, this comes out as government spending. Thus, the amount of purchasing power in the community is what's in here. And what is in here, I don't know why I'm looking that out, what is in here as purchasing power, back in 1933, was totally inadequate to buy the goods that are pouring out in the market. Because you see that in addition to, this is money, I'm talking about here, but these factories or the economic system is also pouring out goods and services. And those goods and services will be used up only if there is adequate purchasing power. Here. And here we put it in, goods and services. And that goods and services include the services of professors of history, or administrators, or many others, all kinds, military service, anything you want. Now this is saying for it. Now what is this determined the amount of the purchasing power? It is determined by government spending or whatever's flowing out of here. And what's flowing out of here is largely a result of the credit policies of banks. When banks shifted over from being determined to keep prices low, determined to stay on the gold standard in order to keep prices low, and determined to invest everything they have in claims, in money claims, to make them creditors in a monetary way. When they abandon that and went into concern with equity, real estate, owning property, Gulf Oil, bought the Holiday Inn. Gulf Oil bought the Ringling Brothers Circus, so forth and so forth. This is called increasing the output of fossil fuel. All right, now, when they made that change, they became inflationary. And the proof that they became inflationary is that they expanded credit to the maximum they possibly could. And they persuaded every individual and every corporation, including Georgetown University and every university in the country, to go into debt way over their heads. For example, 15 years ago to approximately 8 years ago, every couple of months, I received in the mail a credit card from some credit thing. My son received so many that he couldn't carry them all. And they then had wallets that were this long with transparent. He's 34 now. Never sees any money or touches any money. When he gets paid at the end of the month, he sits down and he writes out checks for all these bills that came in. He's a credit card for everything on God's earth and every bank that you can think of, and all these things. Notice from the front of the stores now, we accept Central Charge and American Bank of America, all of these. This is a new thing. In 1930, banks did not finance consumption. Consumer goods. They only financed investment. And you could not borrow. That's why, if you wanted to buy an automobile in 1930, 40, 50, you had to go to a finance company, not a bank. And Ford Finance had their own finance company. General Motors had their own finance company. And they concealed what they were charging you. They were charging you 18 to 20% interest. And this is why the government passed this honesty in lending thing. They have to tell you now precisely at each monthly payment what goes for interest, what goes for reducing the amount of debt, and what the rate of interest is, even money on a 160 day. On an annual basis. But notice, financing consumption was a totally new thing. Furthermore, they poured these things at you, and today, almost every person is over their head in debt, particularly of the lower class. This is not true of the middle class. The middle class has certain restraints, the lower classes do not. They are deeply involved in debt, and the credit card, they buy all their cars, everything are on credit, and they're using buy all kinds of cars that were recovered, because somebody couldn't keep up the payment. They don't bother investing. They don't care about your credit, really. They sell it to you, and then can recapture it, if you don't make the payments more than a couple of months. And then they can still sell it, and they have got a couple of months payments from you, and they sell it to somebody else and get a couple of months payments from him, and so forth. That's where things go. Now, what we have today then is tremendous amounts of credit coming into here, but notice it's privately controlled. Furthermore, it is almost impossible to find out what's going on. Wright Patman, who is hates banks, just like Henry Ford hated banks, is the head of the House Committee on Banking, has been for years. They tried everything they could to get rid of him. They can't get rid of him. He had an investigation about over 6 years ago on commercial banks, like Morgan Guaranty, National City, First National is now. See, that what they do is they absorb others. Morgan, of course, went out of existence. Morgan partnership went out in 1940 incorporated, and then it went out of existence as a significant bank. But it was merged with one of its commercial banks, Guaranty Bank, and so forth. All of these banks are pouring in credit, but they are all holding equities. Now, the Wright Patent Committee produced a true volume study of the holdings of commercial banks. And every effort is made to suppress that. We do not think things can be suppressed. I assure you, books, government reports, all kinds of things can be suppressed. I tried to get a copy of this two volume report on the credit bank in the United States. And I was told by the speaker's office the speaker himself could not get the copy. That the copies were locked up in the back room, and the employees themselves were searched every time they left the room to make sure they were taken out.
I'd be foolish of me to tell you that I do have that report.
Let me give you another example of what's going on.
Sometimes break into my house, you know. I know many other reports that have been suppressed
at this time. I can give you this from the history of them, just books. And I told you about books that were suppressed. The one on the
China lobby and politics.
It was suppressed. The same in my own book was suppressed, both of them by McMillan. And there were various other groups that books that have been reported to be suppressed.
For instance, Harley Kilgore, Senator Kilgore, West Virginia, for years, sent me all the reports of his committee on monopoly and similar things, and some of these were suppressed. One in particular was suppressed. So the suppression of information. The reason that they want to suppress information is this. This is the chief reason. We now have mutual funds. In the old days, if you wanted to buy shares, this is an equity, you bought 100 shares of General Motors. And this means you could share in their profits, if any, with what's called a dividend. Today, however, they have corporations which buy shares and collect the dividends, so the dividends, they own shares of all kinds of corporations. The dividends come in and go through, they take what they want for themselves, and then they pay out to the people who bought shares in that investment. It's called investment fund. It's called a mutual fund. Now, anybody who invests in a mutual fund is really pretty much nonsense. Because they take out such a share that you do much better to just take your money and put it in a food processing corporation. Food processing corporations for 30, 40, 50 years at least, and I used to follow on a monthly basis, very carefully in New York, were earning 12% or more, even through the Depression. And if the conditions improved slightly, they were making 18%. So if you wanted to put money in something like this, it would be much better. What I'm concerned with, however, is not the fact that middle-class people bought mutual funds and get part of the return from the shares that the corporation bought using the money to pay to see. What I'm concerned with is who votes those shares for the directors. Because that is what you gave up, not what it needed. People would do any good because it was impossible to knock out a board of directors, no matter what they're doing. But these credit banks vote the shares. This means that if you are a very, very big shot banker, you do not control just the corporations that you have investments in. You control those corporations that you can vote the shares that are being held by the trustee. Now, who is the trustee? The trustee is the trust company that was given control of the shares by this corporation as a guarantee that payments would be made. And these are the biggest four or five commercial banks in the country, including Walden Guarantee, First National City,
Chase Manhattan, and the three of them, and a couple of others. So they can control every significant corporation in the United States. A small group of people. Now savings are the net. Oh, suppose the government has an unbalanced budget. This means that the government is putting in savings and spending here more than it's taking from the people in taxes there. They have to get that from the banks. When I drew the diagram here, I put the banks up here, but it became too complicated. In other words, if the government needs money, it has to come down to these bankers and borrow from the banks. This is the way we sold the war bonds in World War II. We had 7 big war bond drives in World War II. I never bought one. Because they were a lie. And they had Bob Hope and everybody that you ever heard of. In those days, they really had some people. Some female actresses in Hollywood.
You saw the figure that came out yesterday. There's only one female actress in Asian history in Hollywood today. And I do not go for Bob or Spicer. It's not my type.
Anyway, now they sold these bonds to the public. Series D. That's a lot. The drive went on for 60 days or 90 days, or whatever they said. And they gave occasionally a score. They were going to raise $7 billion. And they said, at the end of the 60-day drive, let's say, at the end of the 50th day, they had sold almost $1 billion. All right, on the 61st day, you read in the newspaper, the big sevens went over the top, the victory drive. Every one of them went over the top. It's a lie. What they did is, just before midnight, on the last day, they gave the rest of them to the bank. And the bank is paid for them in credit. Now the difference here, you read in my book, that all the difference in the world between financing a war and selling bonds to people, that is deflationary. But selling bonds to a bank, that is inflationary. Because they create the money to buy the bond and add therefore the supply of money. But if you, as a person, went and bought from the Treasury the Series E bond, then you give them your money, and you're taking money out of the system. Now, even when they spend it, they only can put back the money that you gave them. And they do not increase the supply of money. The result is then that the whole system today is inflationary. It's inflationary because that is what the small group of people who really dominate the system want. And they want it because they are in equities. Now, the real reason they want that is not just because their value of their equities is going up. Every piece of land they own, every security they own and control is going up. It isn't that. It's that having pushed the credit to the absolute limit in everything they control, including everything in the United States, today, every significant entity in the United States, as those corporations, is technically bankrupt. By technically bankrupt, I mean that their assets are less than their debts. Now, you know a lot of these, and they'll always tell you it's crookedness. Well, sure, it's crookedness. Even ones that didn't go bankrupt are run crookedly. But you know Boeing, Penn Central, New York City, Lockheed, Pan American, says that, you know. In England, Rolls Royce, Chrysler of England, which is now pulling out of England. All these are bankrupt.
They're all bankrupt because they borrowed more money than they could possibly ever pay.
All right, what you do is exactly what the Germans did in 1923. That is, you deliberately inflate. If you can double prices, you cut the burden of your debt in half. Because if you double prices, you can sell and you're making paper roads. If you double the prices, and they certainly did double now, it's 110, it's $1.10 for 2 pounds of paper roads today. Even though you can buy it in the house store for 29 cents a pound. But they got some nice tax to see it over. And they've gone from 59 cents to $1.10 in a little over a year. They doubled it. So this means they sell, if they sell the same amount of oats, they take in twice as much money, and it means that the burden of their debt has been cut in half. Now notice what happened in Germany. By the end of 1923 in Germany, the inflation had gone to the point that money was worthless. Worthless. And all debts had been wiped away. No one would even take the trouble to collect a debt. Who be specific? In 1903, a German takes out a 20-year endowment insurance policy. He pays so much a year, and at the end of 20 years, he can collect 100,000 marks. In 1923, when that 20-year endowment policy becomes mature, and he can collect 100,000 marks, he will not collect it. He will not write a letter saying, send me the check, because a postage stamp costs 4 billion marks. And nobody's going to spend 4 billion marks to mail a letter saying, send me a check for 100,000. It was all wiped away. Now, what the Dawes plan tried to do, of course, was reestablish such a debt on German industry, the German railroad system, in order to use this new debt income to pay reparations payments. That was the Dawes plan, 1924. But of course, then they wiped that away, isn't it? J.P. Morgan did all of this, as you know, from reading my book. The Young Plan, this is January 30th. And so forth were all handled by him. Dawes was one of his students from Ohio, as I said, the United States and so forth. He was a banker from Ohio. And Owen D. Young, the Young Plan, was the head of the Schenectady General Electric, which was entirely a Morgan firm. He was an employee. All right. Insatiable greed. Well, let me say this. Can be satisfied only by total control of economic life through corporations, reducing all individuals to a subsistence level. In other words, these must all be reduced to just a level of subsistence, and all wealth is owned by this. Now, for thousands of years, the rich people exploited the poor. Today, there's no point in exploiting the poor anymore. They have to down the subsistence level. They haven't got enough to validate it away. And they're getting very unruly. Notice, New York has gone bankrupt, but nobody's suggesting they cut welfare payments. They don't dare. So they're going to cut all government services, garbage, police, fire, everything. Because they don't care what happens to the middle class. They ought to get themselves killed in New York. Oh, it's too bad. Now, these, you must get the money now from the middle classes. The middle classes are the creditor class. And you take away from them the value of their credits. I have insurance policy. I told Amy $100,000. I don't know what it is. I never even paid attention. I just know that for years they've taken out of my hundreds of dollars a month. They've taken out of me. For retirement and these various things. Now, all of this will become valueless as the inflation continues. So you ask, why is this? Notice, I told you, the liberals want to destroy communities and create isolated individuals. Like that judge in Boston who took yesterday over of Boston High School. He, the judge, is going to run himself.
for a minute. If conservatives want to reduce government expenditures, remember the system I put up here. Government, corporations, the field of action, communities, individuals. And they all act in the field of action, which is public decision making. Corporations and the corporation people want to destroy government. You see Jerry Ford constantly saying we must reduce the role of government. The Secretary of the Treasury is committed to reducing the role of government to nothing if possible, because he's a devoted disciple of Ayn Rand. Devoted, and of course, personal friends. They're going to reduce government to almost nothing. And that's what the conservatives are doing. The liberals want to destroy the unities, like this guy. If you destroy both government and the unities, what you leave is corporations and atomized individuals. And that's what they're working for. It won't work. For this reason, we cannot retain law and order with atomized individuals. Here they finish this metro subway system. Very few people will ever go on. It will not be safe. You can only control human behavior by internalized controls, not by externalized controls. And you can only get internalized controls in communities. So what we have is the conservatives and the liberals are both working for the same goal, to reduce our society's atomized individuals, and they will then be subject to corporations at a subsistence level. Well, I'll never get that far. Because you can always opt out if you want. You can always start eating organic food and doing things that are important. Time is up. Thank you very much.